Welcome to PodX Medicine. This is the official podcast of the Academy of Extreme Environment Medicine. I am your host, Sunny Whitfield, and today I have my co-host, Bridgie. How are you, Bridget?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm really good. I'm really excited today, actually, because we've got a really interesting guest. I had the benefit of actually meeting her. Actually, Bridgie, you're the one who put us in contact. You're the one who actually put us together in the same room. I met Penzi at a conference this year, and hearing her speak kind of blew my mind a little bit. Where did you first hear about Penzi?
I was lucky enough to hear about Penzi from the AWEM's president, Kieran, actually, and he definitely spoke you up heaps, Penzi, about all your amazing experiences and where you've been and what you've been up to. And that's why we had you on our panel discussion.
And that also would probably then indicate to me, if Mr. Rat is involved, that Penzi is from across the ditch. So let's bring Penzi in. Dr. Penzi Dinzel, thank you so much for being here today. How are you?
I'm great. I'm stoked to be here. It's, super exciting.
You've been running around getting your car serviced and all kinds of things during our timing issues, but we've all made it.
Yeah, we've all made it now. It was just one of many things that had to happen today.
Penzi, as long as the car's running.
The car is running, which is good, which just in time for me to use it for like, I don't know, one trip and then park it for 2 months, basically. That's what I do to it. That's why it needs to go to the mechanic all the time.
While you were running after your car, I was actually running home because my car got hit by a branch during the Knot Cyclone earlier this year. So I've been on an e-bike and my feet, which has actually been good for me. But Penzi, people don't want to hear about me or from me. They're curious to know about you and who you are and what you've done. Can you just give us a quick introduction?
Yeah, so kia ora, I'm Penzi. I'm from New Zealand, so I'm from across the ditch, which is very exciting. This is definitely the best side of the ditch.
not biased at all.
Yeah, I'm not biased at all. This is just a great place. I'm a doctor. I'm, I think, 9 years out of medical school at this stage, but I have not really been, have not done a full 9 years of work, that's for sure. I basically try and build as many adventures as possible into life. So I'm always, doing a little bit of work and then finding a way to get more time off and go on some more adventures. So some of my, my biggest adventure that I've done was an 85-day long traverse of New Zealand's Southern Alps. And that's actually set me up for about a week's time, I'm heading off to do 7 weeks through Fiordland so that I can turn that Southern Alps adventure into a whole South Island traverse. Other than that, I've worked a little bit on Antarctic ships. And I had something else I was going to say and I forgot it.
Expedition doctoring in Nepal at some point?
Oh, I think I read.
You missed that bit out?
I missed that bit out. There we go. That's the thing I should have said. So I also worked as an expedition doctor, team doctor for climbing mountaineers at Everest Base Camp last season. So that was 2025 season. And that was really, really cool.
This seems like a reasonably pivotal moment in someone's career, being the base camp doctor at Everest. And it's the thing that slipped your mind. You actually had to have Bridget remind you. I find this unique, Bridgie, because I find so many people in these circles or in this environment, they're not necessarily chasing glory, but some of them have done so many things that something as pivotable, and personally and professionally changing as being the doctor on Everest Base Camp can slip your mind. Penzi.
I think it's because right now, everything is just Fiordland. Like, that's all I'm doing at the moment is just running around for this Fiordland adventure. So I was, prior to our timing issues, I was, desperately trying to service my bikes. In 20 minutes, I'd be inside on time. And then, it's sorting the car. And, I've got a whole, list on I would call it a whiteboard. It's actually my fridge over there. That's just everything that needs to be sorted. So I think my brain is just stuck in Fiordland.
Are you walking? Are you riding? Did you just say you're servicing your bikes? Tell us more about this trip.
It's tramping. So New Zealand word for hiking. Basically, we'll be dragging ourselves backwards through the bush with no tracks and no huts or anything really for most of it. And we're also taking pack rafts. So there'll be some water travel, so some rivers and some lakes and some of the fjords, which will be really exciting. And then when we finish that, we come out to a place called Rarako Car Park, which is still kind of in the middle of nowhere. And I want to, because I when I did my Southern Alps Traverse, I went all the way up to the top of, well, to Fairwell Spit, which is the northernmost point of the South Island. And so we're going to bike down to Slope Point, which is the southernmost point of the South Island. So just for the completeness. So the bikes are going to be used for like 2.5 days at the very end.
And how do you get supplies? Do you have to take everything with you? Are you hunting? What's happening?
I cannot hunt to save myself. I definitely can't carry all of everything we'd need. So, yeah, we have supply drops that are going in. So three of them are going in by boat and one of them's going in by helicopter.
Wow.
So that's basically what I've mostly been organising. And yesterday I actually had to do a test pack to see if the largest supply drop and the pack raft and everything else I need fit in my pack. And they do, but only just.
Can I just ask, sorry, you said something about you're going to do this amazing journey and then end up in a car park.
Yeah, it's a road end car, like, you know, it's the end of the track.
Right. You Kiwis couldn't get a more decent name than the car park?
Well, it's Rarako Car Park. It's, yeah. It's an unknown car park.
I mean, if I travelled for 7 weeks across an expedition, I would just hope that I would be coming to somewhere that's called like Rainbow Lodge or, you know, Happy Valley. I don't know. Like,
there is a lodge park. There.
Well, there's a lodge at the car park.
Not ending there. I am going down to, yeah, Slope Point, because that has a more final kind of sense, being the southernmost point. Not even really planned how we're getting back from Slope Point. It's fine. It'll sort itself out. That's 2 months away.
Yeah.
This is ultimate, like, it's the journey, not the destination. Should we care if it's called a car park? Why should we care about how we're getting back? Let's just journey there and journey back. How many of you are involved in this, Penzi?
So I've got two people who are going to join me for the whole thing, and I actually met them through AWIMS. Yeah. So they actually, last year I gave a short little lecture about getting started in expedition medicine, and they attended that. And then they reached out afterwards and were keen to come and join my expedition. So they're going to come and join last year as well. So that was great. And then I've got lots of other friends who are keen to join for sections, but it's just kind of, yeah, we're just still waiting on various things, like, will the timing work out? And one friend who had a serious knee injury last ski season, who is just waiting till the last minute to decide if her knee is up to it or not. So hoping more people will join, which is what happened on the Southern Alps Traverse that I already did. But yeah, we'll see.
What are the comms like? How do you communicate with people while you're out in the bush for 7 weeks?
You try not to. It's real nice. You don't have to answer your phone.
That's great.
We will carry an inReach though. So that means that people can actually track where we're going off the inReach, because there'll be a daily kind of update of here we are. And the ability to send some messages back and forth and get up to date weather forecasts and things like that.
There's an interesting question that gets floated around this space in both the experienced and inexperienced clinicians. And it's so often, you know, how do I get involved in something like expeditionary medicine? And I find it a really almost backwards facing question, because if we use someone like you with your clinical experiences and your adventure experiences, you're not actually waiting for an opportunity to come to you. You're actually creating the opportunity. And I think there's a lot of power in that. And there's actually not enough of a spotlight on these types of things, because as professional clinicians, let's talk paramedics, emergency nurses, doctors in the emergency room, even GPs, we're all actually trained to wait for something to happen. And so I joke around with some colleagues sometimes and say, we're all just professional waiters. We wait, we wait, we wait. And when something happens, we respond. And that doesn't promote opportunity in the expedition medicine space, as far as my career has shown me, because if you sit around waiting for an opportunity to happen, you're going to wait a long time. In fact, there's a really good Dr. Seuss book that talks about the waiting place is where you don't want to be. And I've always amused myself, because that's where we work. But I'm hearing, you know, like, you've done some amazing stuff at Everest Base Camp that you forgot about. You've done this 85-day trek. But you're actually creating your own opportunities by literally looking at something, planning it, and having the courage to actually execute it. And like you just said, you wish more people would be involved, but so many people actually don't have that courage. I find this a really unique discussion, Penzi, because I'm really inspired by it, and I hope other people are too. You've sat there and basically gone, I'm going to walk, paddle, and pedal for 7 weeks in that direction and essentially hope the weather plays nice and hope that my colleagues and teammates can get through it. This is actually, in essence, what an expedition actually is. It's not paying someone to take you somewhere. It's actually planning something. Where did you come up with the idea to travel for 7 weeks?
Well, like I said, it was it's a continuation of the previous expedition I did for 85 days through the
Yeah, 85 days wasn't long enough.
It's going to be shorter. Yeah. This one's like going to be 50, 55 days, something like that. Yeah, well, once I'd done that one, I had to go and finish off what I started, basically, because when I planned that one, it was actually supposed to be the whole South Island, Fiordland included, but it needed to fit in a certain time frame. We needed to get to the Mount Cook region, you know, at a certain time in order to have the conditions we needed to cross safely through that region. So it meant that I ended up having to cut the Fiordland section out of it. So it was, because it was there from the start, it was kind of like, well, when I cut it, it was like, well, I've got to, got to go back and do that.
I've got to go back.
It's okay. I was going to say the idea for doing a Southern Alps Traverse is, well, there's actually quite a few people. There's every summer there'd be one or two parties, or pretty much every summer there'd be one or two parties who do some sort of long traverse through the Southern Alps of New Zealand, excluding the people who walk the Te Araroa. Which is a very cool thing in itself, but a bit different.
And that is what, sorry?
The Te Araroa is the trail that you can walk. That's the whole length of New Zealand.
Wow. Whoa. I didn't even know it existed. Wow. I'm going to have to read. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah. But so I've had lots of friends who've done similar long traverses through the mountains. I say lots of friends, a handful. And so that was always kind of something that was like, oh, yeah, I'm going to do that. And, you know, most of them did it while they were still at university, and then you got the long summer holidays, and then it just didn't happen timing-wise, mostly because I was always heading off to Switzerland to work as a ski instructor for my summer holidays at university.
Just something else she forgot to mention,
Bridget. Yeah, I was about to say, wait, where was that?
But yeah, so it became something that I desperately wanted to do, but it wasn't going to fit in professional life. And it actually took quite a big nudge from professional life to, you know, free up the time to be like, okay, well, actually, what can we do now? And I actually, what that nudge was, I was actually working in orthopedics, and I have a passion for orthopedic surgery, but I will never be an orthopedic surgeon now. But I actually ended up working in quite a toxic workplace and ended up getting bullied out of that job. And that's when I kind of was sitting there on the couch going, well, what am I going to do now? And that was, yeah, well, I went and worked at the ski field. I applied for an expedition to ski across Antarctica, and I didn't make the cut for that because I didn't have any expedition experience. I was like, right, let's get expedition experience. And that is how Southern Alps Would Love to Do That at some point became a let's do that at the end of 2022.
That's amazing. So you got a few no's and you decide to just make the path yourself.
It's turning a negative experience into a real positive learning opportunity. And I think that's lost on a lot of people. I look back at my career sometimes and I think some of my worst experiences have actually been the best learning moments. And to rebound out of a toxic workplace and decide that you're going to go and get some expeditionary experience, then have you skied across Antarctica? Did we forget that one as well?
No, I haven't yet skied across Antarctica.
It's on the list. I was going to say, it looks like it's on the list.
Have you been to Antarctica, Penzi?
Yes. So I actually work in Antarctica as well. So
there's something else you forgot to mention during the introductions there.
I thought I did mention that.
Oh, okay. Well,
there was something about a boat around Antarctica, but there was nothing about it. So tell us about Antarctica.
Yeah, so I work on a boat in Antarctica.
Okay.
So I work on their expedition ships. So they're ships taking tourists down to Antarctica, but you want to take less than 200 tourists at a time. And then you can do expeditions and excursions. You can go camping on Antarctica. You can show people around. You can go drive little boats through little ridiculous channels and icebergs and things like that. So I work there. And so I've done that. I've just finished my third season. I just got back just over a week and a half, or just about a week and a half ago from my third season doing that. And I got that job because they hired me as a first aid responder because I'm a doctor. But yeah, mostly I don't actually do that much medical work. I just hang out with the penguins and drive boats sometimes.
Hey, you took the job as, if I heard this right, as a first aider. I just want to touch on this because this is another interesting, I guess, area that's often discussed or not discussed within these spaces. But so much of the work that is involved in remote and, you know, extreme environments is sometimes, I think it's misaligned with people's expectations. You know, if you're going to be climbing the Himalayas, people for some reason seem to align that with big traumas or big falls. And so often, you know, I'm actually dealing with shingles or I'm actually dealing with dehydration or you know, even mental.
I was handing out cough syrup. That's what I was doing, was handing out cough syrup.
Respiratory problems. Yep. It's very much primary healthcare. And what I've found, and you can certainly correct me if you think I'm going down the wrong path here, but even though I'm working as a clinical paramedic, I quite often find a lot of the work is either aligned with first aid in a remote or extreme environment because we're so limited by the resources we have anyway. So it's really good advanced first aid and it's really good extended field care. It's very similar to being a combat medic. But it's also a lot of primary healthcare, which that doesn't sell on the posters or that doesn't sell in the, you know, the podcast.
It's not sexy.
It's not sexy.
It's not and sexy so healthcare.
There's a lot of ego in medicine, paramedicine, nursing, extreme environment medicine, expedition medicine. We need egos in this area so that you can actually respond and move into the situation that no one else wants to move into. But at the same time, those egos can stop us or prevent us. And I think sometimes, you know, like I've offended people in the past by saying, oh, I was a first aider on that trip. No, we're not. We're paramedics. Well, actually, what I did was first aid. And I've just got a doctor in front of me who's literally done so much in her career that she's forgotten to mention most of it in her introduction, saying to me that I took a job to get to Antarctica as a first aider. Penzi.
Yeah, and I wouldn't change that job for the world. I actually think that that is the best job to have if you've got medical experience in Antarctica. So the way it works is whenever we're off ship, I am responsible for anything that goes wrong, first aid. And when we're off ship, you know, the chances are that slips, trips, falls, you know, potentially some trauma. Maybe someone goes down a crevasse. Hopefully not. The industry would struggle if someone went down a crevasse. So that's not happening. Touching a wooden table here. But that's
it's like, to, is that how you say it? Crevasse? Crevasse? Crevasse?
Crevasse. You're asking a Kiwi how to pronounce crevasse? English words?
No, I've always read it. I've never said it. And I thought it was crevice.
Well, there's crevice, which is like a rock crevice, and then a crevasse, which is in the glacier, and they're spelt differently.
Oh, really? Wow. See, I've just learned something. There you go.
There you go.
Anyway, tell us more.
Yeah. So my role is literally kind of that sort of stuff that happens, like injuries, basically. And then there's a ship's doctor. And their role is to deal with all of the things that happen on ship, like people with seasickness or viral illness or everything else. And so they can't really get off the ship, or they can a little bit, but their role is to be on the ship for that sort of stuff versus my role is to be off ship when allowed ashore, unless I'm there. And then
that's
so I
would awesome.
Be packaging,
You've
dealing with
this.
All of
this
that extended first aid stuff to get us back to ship. And then I would work collaboratively with/under the doctor to deal with anything ongoing. The doctors that I work with on ship, you know, they are always stoked that there's another doctor because they are sole carers. And it gives them the option that there's someone they can call on the ship who can help them in like an emergency situation.
And to have a chat, be able
and
to someone to bounce off.
Yeah. And I wouldn't now, like originally when I was applying for jobs on ships in Antarctica as a way to get there, I looked at ship's doctor jobs and now I probably wouldn't take one because my job is so much cooler.
Wow.
And I have to say that there are so a lot of companies out there that like to have doctors in their first aid responder role. So
that's awesome.
A win. Yep. But there are still old school companies out there that like to take an expedition doctor and not pay them. So
That's a tedious subject that's been raised. I've seen it online floating around the last few weeks. Again, it seems to come up every about 2 or 3 years. People asking for volunteer doctors and volunteer paramedics and volunteer nurses. And there's always people to push back on it, but there's always people to fill those roles, which means it continues as well. And so it's a double edge. I think if people understood the clinical and medical and legal liability they're taking on as a volunteer, they might question whether they should be doing that or not. But hey, it actually raises another just interesting aspect of it for me is, if you're taking on a first aid job, I mean, you said there's some ships who really like having doctors as first aiders. We need to be careful there, though, because if you're employed as a first aider, I mean, there's boundaries of professional practice, there's scopes of practice, but then there's also ethical responsibilities that are kind of colliding here. I know that I can't be a first aider at my son's footy game if I don't hold a first aid certificate, even though I've got an upper registration certificate. So where do you draw the boundaries between I'm a doctor, but I'm employed as a first aider?
Yeah, that's always interesting. I mean, granted, I haven't had to do a lot of first aid in Antarctica, which is a good thing. Our goal is to not. Basically, I tell the team that their goal is to make sure I don't have to work.
great goal.
If you have a safety right, then I don't actually have anything to do. Yeah, but it is definitely something that's always kind of being thought about and considered, and I think it changes depending on who your first aid responder is. You know, on the ship there are other doctors doing that role who obviously then have a little bit more scope, but there are also people who are wilderness first responders who also work in that space who obviously have a lot less scope and a less experience per se. And I think basically there's a set kit that we take ashore, which has, you know, lots of dressings and bandages and things, but really, really limited medications. Like, it's got an EpiPen and a little bit of paracetamol, ibuprofen, basically. And I think that sets the boundary pretty clearly about what is and isn't. And I wouldn't go and take a whole bunch of stuff out of the doctor's office and bring that. If I want more heavy duty medication ashore, then I'm going to be asking the doctor to come ashore and have the responsibility for that. Yeah, and then same kind of, if I'm helping the ship's doctor, I'm doing that under the ship's doctor, under that
under his instruction, or her instruction, and like, so, supervision,
Yeah, so I have to be, absolutely have to be clear that I'm not actually employed as a doctor. And there's actually this season there were a few times that we had some pretty robust discussions around that between me and the ship's doctor and our management, just to keep the lines really, really clear, and that was really good.
Was that where you put in a situation where you were asked to perform something outside of the first responder scope? Like, or you don't have to talk about it if you don't want to.
It was potential for me to be asked to be outside of scope, based on, so yeah, we had a halal cruise and we had a number of Muslim women. And we were concerned that their expectations might be for them to have a female doctor, but the company, the ship's doctor, was a male doctor, and the company factored that in. And so we wanted to just basically have a pretty clear expectation about that I wasn't employed to be the doctor for them. And yeah, it all ended up being nothing. They didn't mind. They were very happy to be treated by the ship's doctor without that ever being raised. But I did actually go and remove my qualifications from my bio for that trip, which was interesting.
What bio? Like, do you have a ship bio? Yeah. Or?
So we have a ship bio that's stuck up on the wall, so they know who all the guides are. And I went and removed my medical school qualifications.
And you also probably removed all the other stuff that you forgot about anyway, so it didn't matter.
Well, there's not very much on it, so yeah, probably.
It's so interesting to hear these experiences, though, because I find so often some of the most complicated experience are things that we would just never consider, you know, like this is actually a religious understanding issue that's impacting the delivery of clinical care in a remote and austere environment. And it's something that, what, you know, we probably never considered before, we don't discuss enough. And because it wasn't actually impacted, then it's kind of glossed over and, okay, well, that didn't actually matter, when it actually does, because it could put us in some really ethical and legally awkward positions sometimes. And, I mean, that's the nature of, you know, the tourism side of what you'd define as expedition medicine. Normally, when you're involved in the professional side, there's less of these kinds of issues crop up. But I mean, there's some very distinct differences in how people are traveling and exploring. And so when you're taking a paid group of people, setting those expectations before the issues is sometimes, yeah, I guess, the best strategy. But sometimes we've never even considered them. It's like a risk assessment. Your risk assessment only updates when something happens that you hadn't considered.
Yeah. And I think it was really interesting. A lot of thought had gone into that expedition. And I think overall we did really well as a team for providing, meeting the expectations. There was expectations around, and the company made arrangements for having female only, Zodiac boats, so female drivers and female staff helping load those guests in and out of those boats, and because they want not to have to touch a man, and they were really, really
absolutely good about, yes, it.
And there were times we weren't able to provide female staff for all of the things, particularly around safety stuff, and they were great, but it was certainly, that was something that obviously had been thought about and a lot of effort had been put into it from the company beforehand, and then we get on ship and we're like, actually the medicine side of thing is not being considered.
It's like everything but the medicine side got, yeah, considered.
Yeah.
I'm curious to expand a little bit too on the kit that you're carrying. I mean, I'm thoroughly amused. You've figured out that the ship's doctor doesn't have the best seat on the expedition, and you've managed to slot yourself into a role where they actually can't go on shore unless you are there.
The ship's doctor I was working with actually wanted my job. He was like, how do I get your job?
And
I was
like, do we swap? Can we swap?
My job.
Quite humbling, hey? But you referenced the kits are quite rudimentary. If it's going to be a first aid role, we certainly would expect that. But depending on what kind of project or expedition or deployment you're on, is always going to dictate what kind of stores or equipment is going to be available. And I've heard some very interesting bits of feedback from clinicians sometimes. The notions of it was an unprofessional project because I didn't have access to the things that I think make me a clinician. And I find it interesting because, if I'm not at work and I come across, a pedestrian hit by a car, I will always lend assistance and I will always lend leadership if that's what's needed in that circumstance. But I seldom identify myself as a paramedic or a clinician because the expectations suddenly go up exponentially. And I do believe that you can paramedic or you can doctor or you can nurse at certain levels based on the equipment that you have. It doesn't change the fact that you're a paramedic, nurse or doctor, but it certainly does change the way that you can intervene. But I've had colleagues who would suggest that because they can't access certain things that they feel is part of their role, that it would make that approach unprofessional. And I disagree because I think I could be a paramedic with a bed sheet if I needed to, because I could certainly cut that into strips and make all kinds of bandages and dressings and stretches or whatever else I needed to do. I could even make a shelter for the sun or wrap someone in a blanket. Like, there's a million things you could do with just a simple bed sheet. But I don't think that changes the professional approach. You're a doctor heading out on shore and you just told me you've got a couple bandages, a bit of paracetamol and maybe an EpiPen.
Yeah, we take an AED ashore every time as well.
Oh, great. That's good. Yeah, you're basically set.
Something else you forgot to mention. Yep. But having these limitations in your kit, did it in any way make you feel unprofessional in your approach, or do you just adapt and adjust to what is available to then figure out how to do your job?
I think one of the great things about expedition medicine is that it is just doing what you can with what you've got, and you're not always going to have every single fancy thing, but you just make do with what you've got. And it's, yeah, I don't think it limits, well, it limits maybe a little bit of what you can do, but it doesn't limit my professionalism. And, part of the joy of it is the challenge of figuring out what, to do with what you've got. And we had some great moments with one of the ship's doctors where she came and found me, and we actually had a medical student who was part of the team as well, who's just graduated, going to be starting work soon, so he's very excited.
That's exciting.
I know, I'm really excited for him. But yeah, the ship's doctor came and found us with like this bandage, and we were all like for 5 minutes trying to figure out what it even was. It turned out to be a shoulder immobilizer. But so you just make do. And yeah, you're, when you're not in charge of what's getting stocked, then you're going to have some interesting moments with kit from all different countries as well. So,
What do you think you use the most? Like, what would you say you use the most out of your kit?
what in Antarctica or
Oh, yeah, we'll go into
overall?
Antarctica first, and then we'll go your
To everyone.
Southern Alps trip. Oh, and then to Everest. Where else do you go?
Ski
Everywhere.
fields. That's the main ones. Ski fields. Yeah, it's on
Ski
that too.
fields, yep.
Yeah. Antarctica, like I say, I actually haven't had to do a lot of first aid. We've generally done pretty well on the safety, which I think is really good. So I think most of what I use is safety knowledge.
Great.
But yeah, what have we? I don't know. It's probably the odd band-aid. That's probably the main thing that I've done. Yeah. And then Everest was definitely cough syrup. Everyone wanted cough syrup. Every few days when we were getting a helicopter delivery up, it was more cough syrup, please. So
Really?
yeah, that was,
Do,
they were,
is it like
yeah.
a viral illness? Is it dusty? Is it because it's cold? What's, why do
Well, it's
we?
classically at Everest, it's called the Khumbu cough, and it's probably a bit of a combination of all. So Khumbu's the valley that Everest is in, and basically everyone goes into that valley healthy, and by the end they all come out with this chronic cough, which sometimes doesn't go away for months, and it's probably to
Wonderful.
do with,
Sounds great.
yeah, I know, yeah, Everest is so appealing. Mostly to do with the dry, dusty environment, and then also the altitude doesn't help your lungs either. And then, yeah, as much as we work really, really hard, viral illnesses get into base camp and just wreak havoc. And it can be basically, you can be doing fine, get a viral illness, and then you'll probably cough for the rest of your season. We had one of our guides last year got laryngitis, and his voice did not recover for 5 weeks until he was back home. Like, that is just what it is. Yeah. Southern Alps Traverse, strapping tape.
Strapping tapes, yep.
Yeah,
Because
strapping tape.
everyone's on the ski. Oh, wait, no, this is. I was thinking about the ski
Yeah.
fields then. No, this
No,
is for
haven't got to
the
this.
traverse.
Yeah, the traverses, it'll be strapping tape, but it really, again, it wasn't that much. Like, I don't know, last time nothing really went wrong. Hopefully this time also nothing really goes
That'll
wrong.
be this time as well, yeah.
Exactly. So yeah, a little bit of strapping tape. And oh yeah, I went at one stage, I ended up getting a course of antibiotics. And that was kind of like something I hadn't even considered before I went and did the traverse, was taking a course of antibiotics with me in case I needed it. So we're taking a course this time. And the other, I think, amusing thing that I did, I was not carrying this. But yeah, basically, have you guys heard of pitted keratinolysis or PK, which is like an infection you can get on it's bacterial on the soles of your
It's your
feet, and it just,
on your. I was like, is it in your eyes?
No, it's on your feet, and it basically just eats little tiny holes into the, like, the thick skin on the soles of your feet.
Yeah,
And once you've
right.
got that, you've kind of got it for life, but you can make it kind of settle down, which, usually involves antibiotic creams. And I didn't have any antibiotic creams when it decided to flare up, like, probably 50 days into the Southern Alps Traverse. And what I went and found was in a hut, I found some like fuel for a little motor engine, and I went and stood in that. And it was just anything toxic enough to kill the bacteria. And so you make do with what you can.
No open flames near you.
No open flames near me at that time. No. Yeah.
Wow, that's amazing. So it's bacterial, and because it's like moist, it just grows. Is it
Yeah.
painful?
I think if you leave it long enough, it will eventually kind of eat down to a level it could be painful and could cause bigger
Okay.
problems. But yes, the
Bridgie,
trick
it's bad
is
enough.
just.
She went and stepped in fuel.
Yeah, I guess it's painful.
And that's this is why I love these conversations sometimes. It's
Are
just
you taking fuel with you this
not specifically for that
time?
purpose, but I
Fuel in a
am
bucket.
so, yeah. I mean, I'd say that I don't think there'd be any evidence behind what I'm doing, but basically, so I raced God Zone. So we're going to introduce more things I've done into the conversation, but the
Wonderful.
raced God Zone a couple of times now, which is crazy long adventure race. So you basically race for a week. But also like pack rafting, kayaking, and biking are all kind
Wow.
of sections of it. It's about 700 kilometers long. It's a different course every year. You have to navigate while you're out there. You're in a team of four. Raced God Zone, I for a week ahead of time, would soak my feet in mets for a couple of minutes every night just to try and kill off any of the bacteria or, you know, the fungal infections, you know, athlete's foot stuff that you get, just to try and really reduce the load of
What did you mets. Soak it in?
Methylated spirits, mets.
Oh, we used to do that with, I used to do like horse racing, endurance horse racing. And so you'd do like 4 or 5 days, and because your hands get really
you toughen it up. Yeah.
So and I remember once one of the South African guys that I raced with, he was awesome, but he forgot to like label the bottle that it was in. And it was like 40 degrees. It was so hot. We're in Charleville, and we just like finished our first 80 kilometer loop, and I thought it was water. And so I've gone like to chug this methylated spirit. And he's like, oh, no, don't drink that. I was like, yeah, we use it for our hands too. And
it could have been worse, Bridgie. It could have been the methylated spirits that Penzi put her feet in.
But, yeah, just a few minutes to toughen them up and try and hopefully prevent any issues.
Well, that's what we used to do on our hands. It really helped because you can't wear gloves for 5 days. And the reins are like their rope, and most of the horses have no brakes, like – talk to race, you know.
Time.
Yeah, so you just sort of let go in the end. But yeah, that's crazy. So it works for feet too. Good stuff.
So I am doing that for the few days leading into it. Basically, as I started like 2 days ago. I feel like I only have a few days until I start, even though we don't start till the 17th. Because also forgot to mention. 9th to the 15th, I am going to snow and ice guide training. So I'm starting my alpine trekking guide pathway, just as a way to have more kind of things I can do, more bits of paper that say that I'm skilled at things. So hopefully I'll do some alpine trekking guiding at some point in future. And also, I feel like that's another way to get on more expeditions, because not all expeditions take doctors. And as we kind of discussed, a lot of them don't like paying doctors. But if you go as a guide and they pay you as a guide and you just so happen to also be a doctor, that's a great way to do expedition medicine as well. So I'm working my way down a guiding pathway. So that's, 9th to the 15th. And then I have the 16th between, that trip ending and Fiordland. And then off I go. So. Yeah.
The irony in that statement too, I mean, I reflect on, the last 20 years of my career, I would estimate that over half the jobs I've had have actually not been clinical jobs, but I'm there because I have a technical skill and a clinical skill. Even next week, I'm out on a diving trip and it's some pretty high risk diving we're doing, but I'm actually on the dive team. That's what I'm doing. I'm a safety diver, but I'm there because I've also got a clinical skill set, and it's quite handy for them to have it. So, it's like you identified, I'm actually paid to be a safety diver, but I'm employed there with that team because I'm a safety diver and a clinician. They're not going to have the funds sometimes to fund an independent clinician to sit there and wait for something to go wrong. I think on a lot of these trips and a lot of these projects, you actually need someone who has multiple skills to actually be part of the crew. Having someone who's got an isolated medical qualification is actually not going to be a great use of money, because so often we risk assess these things so that things don't go wrong. Like you said, a Band-Aid is probably what you use the most in Antarctica. So having people with multiple skills is such a valuable asset to the teams, but it's also such an important way that you can get far more involved in these opportunities. Hey, you got such a varied experience across, a number of different geographical areas and a number of different elements. Is there something, or is there, what's your top three items as a clinician, or even just as an explorer and adventurer? What are the three things that you would not leave without, regardless of the geography you're going into or the elements that you're going into? I'm genuinely curious here, Penzi.
My camera.
Right. Okay.
So nice. Oh, because you're a photographer as well. I must say, I did Google you yesterday.
Yeah, because all of these in her introduction.
Because I was like, I know you're going to be very humble, so we got to make sure we talk about everything. And there was like a blog post on, I think it's Armadillo or something.
Oh,
and
yeah, that's a recent one. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's where I found out about you having done the Everest base camp, because you hadn't mentioned that. And it also said about like your journey with photography, which is
Yeah.
it's really exciting. Tell us about your camera.
Yeah, my camera is literally just right here.
What's number two?
Can it be a combination item?
Course it can.
So
What's a combination item?
this is my first aid kit.
Oh, we've got to unpack
Awesome.
this, Bridgie. We've got
Come
to
on.
unpack.
I love how it's there waiting.
Okay.
There are people who are listening. They can't necessarily see.
Yes, I know. So
We
now we
will
have to unpack the first aid kit. Well, I
release
have to
this at
say it's
both
small.
avenues. How big is this
It's
thing?
about so this is a normal size, I guess, like beer glass, and it's the same
With
size.
your tea in it?
No, well, so there's a story behind the mocktail tea bags as well. I don't know if we have time,
Here we
but
go.
there's always time.
where I live in Queenstown, I live in this little community called Arthur's Point, which is like quite nice. It's quite just a little tight-knit community still, which is, Queenstown's full of subdivisions, so it's really, really nice. And I got back from Antarctica the other day and went for a walk around, like I always do, around the neighborhood. And there's a new like cupboard just sitting there on the side of the street, and it's a pantry. There's a brand new Arthur's Point pantry where people can just
Oh,
leave things and like take things as they need them. And I found
wow.
these mocktail tea bags in there, so I took them, and they're actually quite good.
That's awesome.
It's something that the Kiwis do so much better than us over this side of these pantries. I actually remember being on I forget the glacier. It was 10 years ago. There was actually one of these pantries that we found, and like it didn't save our lives, but it certainly saved our morale. But I mean, we took stuff from it, but we also felt indebted to put stuff in it. And so we put some of
Yeah,
our
you
best
put
stuff in
stuff
it.
in there.
But
Yep.
it was like being able to trade in the middle of nowhere. It was amazing. I've never experienced that anywhere else except New Zealand.
Well, I've actually got one on my street and I didn't know what it was because I've just moved up to Cairns. And so and we're sort of out near the back of the mountain here. And I was like, oh, what is this little box? And yeah, it's a pantry. And because we get f when it floods, where we are gets cut off sometimes for a few days. And so everyone stocks it up. So there's heaps in there, and it's wet season right now. So if you can't get to the grocery store,
But it's also
you've got a
45
pantry.
degrees up there. See, where
It's
Penzi is,
very
he's
hot.
living in a fridge, so the stuff stays good.
It's not a fridge
Yeah.
right now. Central Otago is not a fridge in summer.
How hot is it over there?
How hot?
It's too hot for me. I'm upstairs in the sunny part of my house because downstairs is not nice. I don't know. It would, I don't know, 20 something.
How I know it's not that hot? She's got an air conditioner behind her. It's not on.
It's not on. Yeah, that's true. I haven't had to turn it on yet, but the door is open because it's too
We
hot.
never
Wait, I want to
turn
go
ours
back.
off.
I want to go back to this super small first
Yeah,
aid kit.
okay.
You're
Oh,
a
first
kit
aid. Yep.
leader.
This is my first aid kit, which goes on all of my adventures, although it doesn't go overseas. But the first thing in it is actually some spare lenses for sunglasses.
Oh, wow. Okay, cool.
Yeah. Because, if you're on snow or on water or anywhere, like you cannot be without sunglasses. You'll get snow blind. And carrying a couple of spare lenses, yes, they won't fit in. But if you break, lose, drop, someone doesn't have sunglasses, you just tape them on. So that's the
Perfect.
first thing that's in there.
See, you're going around with tape on your eyes, like.
Yeah, I haven't had to use them yet, but it will happen at some point. Then there's a spare shoelace. So it's
Perfect.
such a pain to repack this afterwards. It'll be great. Skin glue, because skin glue is amazing, most useful thing
Is that
ever.
real skin glue, or did you just get the super glue from the hardware store?
No, this is real skin glue.
Okay.
Oh, wow. She's
Four,
fancy.
40 times the price.
It's expired in 2020.
Perfect.
It'll still work.
Still work.
Yeah. There's some Mefix. Do you guys call it Mefix as well? Like the
Oh, is that
Hyperfix
like
tape?
goes like the white tape that goes over the top of or under strapping?
And
Like
it's
fix a
quite.
mole.
We
We
yeah,
call
so we
it
call it
fix a
fix a
mole.
mole.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. Yeah, I have multiple names for it, but yeah. So I have a wee roll of that. There are some. That plastic bag is gone. I have to get a new one. It's good, making me go through the kit. Some aqua, like some water treatment tablets. Like in New Zealand, we don't treat the
Oh,
water.
yep.
I just drink out of any stream or whatever. But it is always useful to have a couple in case you are somewhere where there is no, like the water does actually look dodgy. And actually, we were in the desert in Jordan at one point, just on a, this is just an adventure with friends.
I was going to say the desert in Jordan.
Yeah, we're in Wadi Rum. And we were like day two of our adventures. We climbed up Jebel Rum, which is, I think, the second highest mountain, camped on the top. It was absolutely stunning, like slept outside overnight. It was amazing. And then the next day we're making our way down and it's like seven abseils to get back down. But as we're making our way down, we're running out of water and we kind of wandered into this chasm just because it looked cool, found a dirty puddle at the end. And they were like, damn, we can't drink it because we don't have water treatment tablets. And it's like, well, I do.
You're like, ho, ho, ho.
Yeah.
Here they are.
Worth having. There's some salt. Specifically, so that one started living in there when I started adventure racing, because if you eat a lot of sugary foods when you're racing for 7 days, you'll get mouth ulcers. And it stings like nothing else, but if you put salt straight on a mouth ulcer, it'll go away.
Wow.
So, yeah, but it stings. There's a warning. It will hurt a lot, because I told my friend to do that once and he thought I was just messing with him because it hurt so much. But it honestly makes them go away. So that's, yeah. Yeah, another thing of salt. There's some ondansetron and some domperidone in there. Oh, they're falling apart.
What was the second one? Sorry.
Domperidone.
What's that?
Also anti-nausea sort of.
Oh, lovely. Yeah,
kind of
cool.
More to do with like making your guts move forward. But yeah. Also just
like it's a laxative.
It's not a laxative. It's kind of promotes mobility through the gut. So through the upper gut. So okay. If you're struggling with like your stomach not emptying. So it can be helpful in nausea settings as well.
For my simple brain, it's a laxative. Great, cool.
It's kind of.
I was like, like, do you want to shit yourself? Sorry, no. Can I say that?
There is some aspirin.
Awesome.
Because I think, you know, it's one of the few things. There's a couple of things in here that are kind of like, if I came across someone in the backcountry having a heart attack, you know, it's so such a simple thing to have, you know, it's so small. So I'm like, that's why that's there.
Yep.
This one did not explode everywhere. That is some antacids.
Nice.
Yep. What's next?
I can't believe this all fits in here. This is like a magic bag.
The whole point is it has to fit, which is why you then start, you know, I would not use this in a professional setting. This is only for personal use.
Yeah.
Because basically all my pain relief pills in
like
one.
A little vial. Yeah, nice. Vial.
So there's like paracetamol and ibuprofen mixed in there together. And there's, you know, some antihistamines in there as well. So they're all
perfect
together. I know what they are, but it's obviously it's not recommending this method. Just saying.
Mm-hmm.
I have adrenaline in my first aid kit. That's the other thing that's in there, because if I came across someone having like an anaphylactic reaction, it's such a small, simple thing to carry and it could save someone's life. And yeah, this one's probably expired at the moment, but I do try and update it every few years. I'll have a check before we go into the back.
Why the ampules and not an EpiPen?
Size.
Okay.
Size. Right.
Size.
And
do you, it would be the size of this.
Do you have a needle? How do you, what's in there?
So there is, and I probably need to replace the needle. It's stuck at the moment. Hold on. I'll have to get some other things out first.
No. They've got an anaphylactic reaction, Penzi. I want that adrenaline out.
Well, I took everything out in that case. Cool. So the little film canister that's full of useful things. So there's like some Glad wrap, which obviously can be used for burns, but also can be used to collect water. There's a needle and thread. There's a little bit of paper, and there is a pencil somewhere as well so that you can
perfect.
Write. You know, you can leave a wee note basically and the needle and thread so you can fix something. There is a single augmentin in here. And the thing around that is actually like compound fracture. Like if you have a compound fracture.
Oh, perfect.
Amongst everything else, just have that early. And, you know, your compound fracture in the wilderness, you're probably waiting, you know, you
a few days,
a couple of days even. So if you can at least get an antibiotic and hopefully you'll doing something to minimize that long-term risk of infection. Oh, there's actually two of them. There you go. Two doses.
Oh, wow. So generous.
There's a whole survival bag in here. So
are like, they like
survival blanket, survival bag?
It's a blanket, except it's a bag instead of the blanket because it's a bag's better because it's more enclosed environment. So
it's kind of like one of those big silver alfoil-y type vibe. Awesome.
Yep. Yeah, but slightly fancier than that.
She's just compressed it to the size of nothing. It's amazing.
I was about to say, it's like vacuum
actually,
sealed.
The bag that my first aid kit is living in is actually the bag for that. But yes, I have compressed it. Cool. So now that that's out, I can get my, so I've just got like a little insulin syringe. And like I say, this one's looking
Oh,
a bit
perfect.
sad. It's time to put a new one in here for giving my adrenaline, basically. And then my pencil to go with my little piece of paper. It's all very dusty in here. Then I have another little film canister, and this one says matches on it. And so this is my emergency supply of matches that'll stay dry with like that cut off a matchbox. So I can, you know, it's how I'm going to start a fire.
Awesome.
If, you know, all my other fire methods fail, basically. Tiny, tiny bit of tenacious tape that's not really that useful. And then there's, you know, a very sad looking little bit of bandage around this film canister. But this main function of this film canister has actually got a fire starter in it. So
Oh,
again,
great.
lighting fire. Yeah.
This is like my favorite thing I've ever had on a podcast. Like, just keep going. This little tiny bag just keeps
We're
going
running
and
out.
going.
There's
It's
a safety
the gift
pin. I
that
don't really
keeps
know why
giving.
that's there. There's a needle that is open. That'll be this sort of needle that I will have used to puncture a blister in the past. If I was going to use it again, I would sterilize it and only use it on myself. There is a single Band-Aid. I don't really
Perfect.
believe in Band-Aids in my personal life. And a couple of Steri-Strips in an old kind of container. I basically think, you know, if you want to have a Band-Aid, well, strapping tape and, you know, turn a little piece of that backwards, or the Me-Fix, what do we fix them all, is quite good for Band-Aids and for Steri-Strips. So yeah,
That
that's
bag's not,
everything.
That's not empty.
Band-Aids never stick. Is there more?
Bag is now empty. That's
you know
it.
What I love too, Penzi, about this is every single item that you pulled out of that tiny, tiny first aid kit was justified by you as this is why I'm carrying it. And I think there's so much power to that that I think is lost on a lot of people because people just want so much gear. But again, limitations in size, weight, space. You've justified every single thing that's come out of there. But what I also find really interesting that I think needs you know, a bit of a spotlight is that I'm going to throw a statistic here. 90% of what you pulled out was actually pharmacology. It was drugs. It was things that we can't improvise. And that's certainly
I
something
suppose.
that I've taken through my career is when we're limited by size, weight, and space, you've got to look at what you can improvise and what you can't. So, you know, the first thing I did is I saw your camera's got a lanyard on it. Well, that's great because with a windlass, we can actually flip that into a tourniquet, or we can flip that into something holding a dressing on, or we can actually make an arm sling out
of it. Is that paracord?
It's paracord. It's literally just
so many things that you can do
the
with it
whole
now.
Time, like, I love that you're talking about it, because the whole time I was in Antarctica, my boss was literally saying to me, we have to get you a proper camera strap. I'm like, no, this is perfect.
No, paracord's perfect.
You could even use that to fix a broken tent if you needed to. Like, there's so many things you can do with that cord. And look, there's plenty of people too that will disagree because, you know, there's so many perfect ways of doing it, but this is an imperfect world. So we look at what we can use to implement in what we need. What we can't improvise as clinicians are drugs. And I mean, unless you're walking through a poppy field, but we, you know,
just grind some up.
It wouldn't
surprise
me in the least if Penzi's also decided to cycle across Afghanistan or something weird that she hasn't told us. But drugs.
Well,
are
I've got vague plans with a friend to cycle from Portugal to Singapore.
There we go. All
we'll
right.
See if that ever happens.
There we go.
But drugs is something that you just can't improvise. And so there's certain drugs that certainly I wouldn't want to leave home without. And there's certain drugs that you're actually going to have to leave behind. Everything else can be improvised. That space blanket bag that you had, you know, there's 101 things that we could actually use that. For me, the things that I've learned never to leave home without, if there's nothing else that I can put in a first aid kit, it will be drugs. And it will be strapping tape, because I've learned to do just about anything with strapping tape.
Yeah, and the strapping tape actually doesn't fit in the bag, but the strapping tape is separate. And
I see, because it's so important.
It's so important, and it gets used all the time. And actually, I don't know where my strapping tape is. I'm going to have to find it before the.
Oh no! Are you the only one that carries a first aid kit, or does everyone carry something?
I think most of the people I go on adventures with will carry a first aid kit of varying degrees. I think that we'll go through our first aid kits together and make sure that we've got kind of
That's a good idea.
good like like a good balance and kind of I'm looking for a word and I can't remember it. Compliment. Hopefully we have complementary things in our first aid kits, because there's kind of no point in having, you know, a whole bunch of the exact same things, because weight is going to be so paramount on this expedition, because, you know, pack rafts are heavy, and then we've got to go up to 13, 14 days of food at one point, plus pack rafts on our backs. Like every gram is going to matter. But yeah, most people will carry a first aid kit. I think across the people who I do adventures with, like there's a huge range of some will carry a much bigger first aid kit that will be mostly full of band-aids. And you know, the at the other end, mountaineers think a first aid kit is tramadol and strapping tape. And they're not wrong. You can do a lot with tramadol and strapping tape.
I didn't see any tramadol in your bag.
It is there.
It's in the little canister of the mixed
It's in the mixed
medications.
medications. Yep.
Penzi, you're a tramping, kayaking, biking, exploring, ice-loving, penguin-chasing doctor. I'm sure there's other things that we've forgotten. You've certainly had one of the most wild and varied careers that I've seen in a long time, which I think is just awesome. So I'm going to put you on the spot with one last question, and it's going to be about advice, right? Because there's a lot of junior clinicians, there's a lot of students, there's actually a lot of senior clinicians and experienced people listening to this podcast. What is a piece of Penzi advice that she would give to anyone that is embarking on potentially their first expedition?
We're trying to describe it to the audience.
This is what you're going to be remembered for the rest of your life. This is
Oh yeah, great. No pressure there.
Penzi's advice.
You know, if you're embarking on your expedition, I think just be prepared to have fun more than anything else. Like, you know, if you're at that stage where you've, you know, got an expedition to go on and going to go, you know, work as an expedition medic, like, you know, by the time you're kind of like foot out the door for it and looking for that last sound piece of advice, like you're there because you have the skills, you know what you're doing. You need to just remind yourself of that and just need to start looking forward to kind of going and having fun. And I think that's the same approach I take to a lot of things, is like you get to a point and it's like, okay, we're going now, this is happening, and there's no point anymore in kind of stressing and finding, you know, what's that last thing I need to know or whatever. Like, you know enough and you just have to kind of go with it. And I don't know, I basically at that point when I'm starting out, you just make your mind blank and you just go and go to enjoy.
You've got to
But
enjoy
I don't know, it's
yourself.
not useful advice.
No,
Yeah, go have fun.
No, it's awesome
I think
advice.
it's
That's
powerful.
awesome
You've got
advice.
to enjoy yourself. And I think what people need to understand is that when you move away from all of these structures of support, you're actually putting yourself in a position that you're going to suffer. You're going to be in pain. You're going to be in discomfort. And you need to enjoy that journey. You need to enjoy the ride because that's literally what it's about. There is nothing controlled or comfortable on these things. And you need to enjoy yourself. So, Penzi, I think it's a great piece of advice. I put you on the spot. You came out with a gold nugget. We appreciate you. Folks, if anyone listening wants to reach out to Penzi to ask a question, she is one of the most experienced expedition leaders and expedition doctors you can find. Please reach out to us at the Academy and we will see if we can get you in touch. If you like what you've heard,
I won't be
you can find
responding
us.
till April.
What's that?
Yeah, she's on a big
I won't be
walk for the
responding
next
till
2 months.
April. She did mention that. It's not something she forgot, at least. But if you like what you've listened to, if you've liked what you've seen, I would encourage you to join the Academy. You can find the Academy at academyxmedicine.com.au. But for now, Bridgie, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
And Penzi, you are a legend. Good luck on your 97,000-day walk. We look forward to hearing about it when you get back.